Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. The Broad has opened, but the story doesn't stop there. It is just one of numerous new museums that have been built worldwide in the last few years. What is fueling the art museum binge? And what about the other building with a showy skin in Los Angeles? We'll also find out why residents of Silver Lake are up in arms at the arrival of a Whole Foods.
Why change the name? Why make it any different? Just because we're Silver Lake, you know, closer to Echo Park, it shouldn't be any different. We should have the same Whole Foods.
Listen up for how your supermarket defines your neighborhood. The Broad opened this past Sunday with the arrival of the first wave of 85,000 people who've signed up for timed visits to the free museum. And the critics are more or less happy with the building too. Perhaps the most colorful reaction came from Guardian writer Oliver Wainwright.
It's so theatrical. That's what I love about it. You know, you enter into this kind of cave-like underworld that could be the entrance to a Bond villain's lair and go up this escalator, and you have kind of glimpses and peeks into the archive. And then you open out into this incredibly sublime, toplit, you know, acre-wide gallery space, which when they take away those temporary walls for occasional shows will just be spectacular.
But does that make Eli Broad the bad guy in a Bond film?
I suppose it does, although what he's doing is providing 2,000 works of contemporary art. So I think we can cast him as the good guy in a slightly villainous building. I guess so inside I think it works beautifully. From the outside I have various problems with it, which I think are symptomatic of LA and the way LA as a city has developed. So, I mean, to me the most shocking thing is that it sits on a three-story car park.
That was Oliver Wainwright. And architect Elizabeth Diller had this to say. After 5 years of grappling with construction challenges and fitting a civic building into the heart of car culture.
I started maybe with a little bit more irony and I ended up with more earnestness about, you know, how downtown could grow a little bit.
For some observers, however, this jewel box of a building and the Broad's gift of 2,000 artworks is part of a broader economic trend that we shouldn't overlook.
We want to remember that between 2000 and 2015, more museums opened worldwide than the entire 19th and 20th century.
Nitsan Shakid is a professor at Cal State Long Beach.
It represents a moment in history where an individual can have so much disposable income that they basically out-resource cities and counties.
So what about that stat about museum building in the last 15 years? In the last couple of years, we've seen the Fondation Vuitton in Paris. We've seen the Prada Foundation in Milan. There's a big new museum in Moscow designed by architect Rem Koolhaas. It seems that everywhere you look, museums are opening. Why are we having this global museum boom? Here's LA Times culture writer Carolina Miranda.
Well, I think it's a number of reasons that we're seeing that. I mean, what we're seeing is also a little bit of a private museum boom. It's not necessarily public institutions that are opening, but private institutions established by individual collectors. So, you know, the Broad Museum here in Los Angeles, Miami is a great example of a city with a ton of sort of private museums. You have the Rubel collection, you have the Dela Cruz collection, you have the Marty Margulies collection. You can just go from one collection to the next, and they're all privately held. I think it's for a number of reasons. One, all of this parallels sort of the growth, the sort of spectacular growth of the art market and art fairs, and art as this symbol of culture like no other. It's like, you know, you can be a builder of really cheap homes in the valley, but if you build a museum, all of a sudden, you know, you become incredibly cultured. And
you are you referring to Eli Broad, who made his millions with Kaufman Broad, that was a home builder?
But perhaps, you know, you have other people that have made it in real estate development. You have other people that have made it in brokerage. You have other people that have made it, like the De La Cruz's, a big distributor for Latin America, for Coca-Cola. Like, they've all made their money in these, like, corporate ways. Well, what makes them more than just your average corporate mogul? They buy art. It makes them cultured. It makes them interesting. They can leave a quote-unquote legacy. So I think you're seeing some of that. It's paralleling sort of the rise of the art market, you know, this global 1% class. You know, at the time of rising inequity, you have a smaller and smaller group of people with a greater and greater amount of wealth. They're buying the art market to some degree is entirely floated by this cohort. And what we're seeing is that rather than supporting public institutions with their collections, they often build their own institutions. And I think, you know, I think this is a phenomenon that goes beyond art. You know, you go to Silicon Valley and, you know, all of the Silicon Valley companies like Google, rather than help improve the municipal transportation infrastructure, what do? They set up their own private bus lines to take their employees to their Silicon Valley campuses. And so I think that's to some degree what you see with these art museums. It's like, oh, I'm not going to support the public institution. I'm going to build my own. I can slap my name on it. I can always be assured that this collection will be shown in the way that I want. And, you know, it's certainly not new. You know, Henry Clay Frick built a museum for himself in Manhattan. You know, Norton Simon took over the Pasadena Art Museum here in Los Angeles. It wasn't entirely his collection because he took over the holdings of the Pasadena Museum as well. But it was pretty much based on the works that he had acquired. So it's not a new phenomenon, but I think with this sort of rise of the 1%, it's just kind of added rocket fuel to that equation.
So what are these museums offering to us? Are we going for the art? Are we going because other people are going? Are we going because increasingly museums provide other experiences, cafes and outdoor places to hang out in and pop-up events and all sorts of other entertainments?
I think the latter point is definitely a big part of it. I think museums in the last decade have really become event-driven and experience-driven, not just in sort of the pop-up events that they create, but even in the type of art that they commission. So, for example, this November, you have the Rain Room coming to LACMA. This was it's a work of art where you step into a room, it's raining, but then when you step in, the rain stops. When it was at MoMA, it was savaged by the critics. Savage, you know, is this kind of like blank piece of art. What does it even mean? It's more a design piece than real art, so on and so forth. It didn't matter. Like, people went to see it. They wanted to see it. They wanted the selfie in front of it. It was this real sort of like crowd-pleasing experience.
It's been stated probably for the last 25 years that the museums are the latter-day cathedrals, that we've become a far more secular society, but we still need a kind of sacred experience. We still need a contemplative experience. Is that an overwrought cliche, or is there some truth to that?
There's probably some truth to that. I mean, I always like to say that performance artists are like the martyrs of our age. Like, we don't have like saints like going up in flames for us, so we'll like watch some guy stick pins in himself.
Carolina Miranda writes the Culture High and Low blog for the Los Angeles Times. So the Broad is interesting in terms of global museum trends. It's also interesting architecturally for many reasons, one of them being its much talked about veil. And that veil is an example of a movement in architecture to wrap buildings in a so-called performative skin, meaning an outer layer that both looks good and performs functional tasks. Here's the architect Elizabeth Diller.
The veil would absorb light. It would handle the building's large spans, it would meet the street line, it would gesture to the public at its far corners and would create a shaded arcade, and the street would leak into the lobby through the veil.
It's a trend made possible by digitization and the ability to design and fabricate and measure a building's performance based on numerous metrics. The process is called parametric design, which is a phrase you should know if you want to sound knowledgeable around architects. Again, Elizabeth Diller.
So we're able to look at all sorts of layers of information, like form, like quantity of light, even the amount of glare.
But parametric design also permits architects simply to have fun with facades. The tools exist to design a zany-looking skin and build it. And that tendency reminds Liz Diller of an earlier architectural trend. Some of you may remember it, postmodernism. She explained to me in an earlier phone interview.
We call that facadism or facotomy. Facotomy.
Facotomy.
And, you know, it's kind of a perverse thing to really separate the facade from the inner workings of the building. I think that, for me, architecture that has value and has longevity and is smart is when the entire building is working together. I hope that we don't go back to just skins. And, you know, there are definitely some attempts to dress up old buildings with new skins and call it a day. And it's a little bit like it's a very superficial way of thinking about architecture.
Liz Diller was not referring to any specific building with this comment, but it so happens that while all eyes have been on the Broad skin, another one has been emerging just a few miles west. It's also a museum and it's due to reopen in December, but passers-by cannot miss it already. Among them, Curbed LA contributor Marissa Gluck.
It's the remodel of the Peterson Museum, the car museum in Mid-City, right across from LACMA.
And you had some pretty choice terms to describe it.
I believe I called it the Guy Fieri of buildings. It's very loud. It's somewhat obnoxious. It is clearly meant to evoke car design and racing, and I don't think it does a particularly good job at that.
That's Marissa Gluck. Back to the LA Times' Carolina Miranda. What's your reaction?
You know, pure insanity. It's like this is a building that is just willfully, populistly, awesomely bad. You know, it's just, and it's not apologetic about it. You know, I don't even know what happened. It may have involved hallucinogens. It may have involved a pileup on the 405. But that it's this building, this sort of like strips of sailing metal undulating all over the corner of Fairfax and Wilshire. It's like, I hate it, but I have to admire.
It's chutzpah.
It's chutzpah, for lack of a better word I can say on the radio.
There's a lot of talk about the character of LA, you know, and we have over the road, we may see a new building emerge by Peter Zumthor on the site of four of LACMA's older buildings. And the new design is being pitched to us as a building that somehow captures LA, some LA-ness. Doesn't the Peterson Automotive Museum skin job capture some LA-ness?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think part of what makes LA great, and I say this as somebody who grew up in LA, is that it's deliriously uncouth. You know, that you can just do and say things here that just would not be cool in you know, a place like New York or Boston, where you're adhering to all of these, like, class and patrician values and what is taste and what is not taste and so on and so forth. Here you can come and put up your restaurant in the shape of a derby or your tamale shop in the shape of a tamale. Like, that is what LA is. And to some degree, that building perfectly captures that delirious uncouthness. You know, this idea that LA is a place where you can come and just be what you want to be, whether it fits into these sort of like crazy notions of what's appropriate or not.
And what is appropriate or not is very definitely being tested on the other side of the road. The Peter Zumthor design for the LACMA replacement is very definitely aspiring to be, if it gets built, the absolute embodiment of good taste. I think it's terribly funny that it's but a few yards from the Peterson Automotive Museum remodel.
It's but a few yards from the Peterson Museum, and also it's going to be next door to the Academy Museum, where they're talking about adding Renzo Piano's auditorium, like, which to in my mind it looks like the alien from Alien sort of like sticking its tentacles into the building. And then on the other corner you have a Googie Diner. It's kind of this, the only other intersection of sort of such insane architecture I can think of in Southern California is the Crystal Cathedral. Like, it's just like how much more insanity can you put on one corner of Los Angeles?
Carolina Miranda is an arts writer for the Los Angeles Times. She also helms the Culture High and Low blog. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Next to a good news story in Los Angeles preservation. Clifton's Cafeteria, the venerable eatery on Broadway just north of 7th Street in downtown, is opening its doors after $10 million worth of renovations. Clifford Clinton opened the beloved comfort food restaurant in 1935, and now developer Andrew Myron is reopening it to serve a new generation. Longtime patrons will find the new Cliftons to be much the same, but also quite different. Gideon Brower went to a sneak preview and he filed this report.
80 years and 170 million people have gone through these doors. I'm looking forward to another 170 million in another 80 years.
That's Andrew Myron at the long-awaited ribbon cutting for Clifton's Brookdale Cafeteria. Myron spent the past 4 years reassuring people that, yes, the restaurant will eventually reopen, and yes, it will still serve mac and cheese and Jell-O.
Here's Clifton's cake. It's a vanilla cake with an almond buttercream.
Pastry sous chef Janet Greenblatt gave me a guided tour of the dessert bar during a festive preview of the new restaurant.
Down here you have a lavender cream ambrosia. Next to that is our Jell-O special, which is a Greek yogurt pastry cream, streusel, honeyed strawberries, Jell-O and whipped cream.
That Jell-O dessert is an awkward but nonetheless apt metaphor for the building's spectacular new interior. It takes a beloved key ingredient, the theatrical, woodland-themed ground floor, and surrounds it with elements that make it fresh, contemporary, and no doubt significantly more expensive. Myron has not only vastly expanded and updated the fanciful interiors, as with a new three-story open space that's dominated by an artificial redwood tree designed to accommodate both a fireplace and occasional performances by aerialists. He's also uncovered some elements of the Booze Brothers restaurant that predates the establishment of Clifford Clinton's cafeteria in 1935.
It's got this 1920s tile work that's been exposed, and that's all been beautifully restored as well.
L.A. historian Chris Nichols, who writes the Ask Chris column for Los Angeles Magazine, has had an inside track on the epic renovation. We found a quiet spot to talk in a basement room crowded with furniture, old kitchen equipment, and a gigantic museum-quality geode.
It's creepy down here.
This dark, dank space is part of Myron's long-term plan to serve up to 2,000 people on five floors of bars, restaurants, and public areas.
After floor one and floor two are open, the next floor, I believe, that's happening is the nautical room, the map room. All these ancient globes and hourglass and machinery and things that he's put together are in a room that's dominated by a boat. There's a big boat up there and these great murals. And then this basement space is coming back as a bar. And then the top floor, I believe, will be a steakhouse restaurant eventually.
Included in those themed spaces still to come, a tiki bar that incorporates decor items from the late lamented Bahuka family restaurant in Rosemead.
There's a big tiki up there. I saw him floating around.
As dramatic as all the changes are, Chris Nichols says they're in keeping with Clifton's long history of finding new and surprising ways to keep people coming in.
There were musicians here at one point. There was a woman that took your picture. There was a matchmaker service here. There were all sorts of weird things that Clifton's did to evolve over the years. And this is just another step in the evolution.
For DNA, I'm Gideon Brower. In the basement at Clifton's.
I'm Frances Anderton. This is DNA. After this break, some Silver Lake residents are up in arms at getting a new and different kind of Whole Foods. Why? And Paul Goldberger on just why the architect Frank Gehry redesigned his name.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. In a moment, Paul Goldberger on just why Frank Gehry redesigned his name. Before we get to that, though, let's go to Silver Lake, and specifically the corner of Glendale Boulevard at Fletcher. That's where a new Whole Foods is supposed to open next year. You'd have thought that many locals would be pleased about the news, but no, it turns out some are miffed, because the company has selected this site to open something new and different.
Looking at my list, organic chicken, kale salad, and a lemon twist. Some girl in yoga pants is looking at me funny. I'm just trying to find a decent Pinot Noir for under 20.
KCRW's Avishai Artsy has the story. Hello, Avishai.
Hi, Frances.
So what's new and different about this Whole Foods, and why did it get people upset?
Well, this is something new that Whole Foods is trying. It's a budget version of Whole Foods.
Isn't that a contradiction in terms?
Well, Whole Foods is trying to reach out to a different audience, young millennials who want to eat healthy but don't have a lot of money to spend. So they're starting this new store called 365 by Whole Foods Market. Think of it kind of like the way Trader Joe's mostly sells Trader Joe's products and then a few other things. So this will be the same thing. They'll sell kind of the store brand, generic Whole Foods food, and then maybe a few other things on the side, but it'll be kind of a stripped down, or as they like to say, streamlined version of Whole Foods. There was a video that the company posted online with the head of the chain, Jeff Turnus, in which he describes the concept behind the store.
365 will be fresh, healthy, exciting, hip, cool. It's going to look great when you walk up to it. And it's going to have amazing team members, knowledgeable team members, and we're going to have a lot of fun.
Fresh, hip, cool, you know, isn't that Silver Lake?
That's Silver Lake in a nutshell, right?
Why would residents be upset?
Well, what we're hearing now are people who were really looking forward to the full Whole Foods experience, because that was originally what was coming. And they're kind of standing up for their vision of Silver Lake, which is up and coming, you know, people who earn six figures, who can afford to buy homes in the neighborhood. And they see it linked to the property value of their homes. And they don't want their neighborhood to be seen as budget or less than. They want to be seen as a wealthy community. So I talked to this woman named Dawn White. She's a music marketing executive. And when she heard the news about the budget Whole Foods, she started a petition online about a month ago to get Whole Foods to change their minds. So here's what she told me.
I think myself and, you know, some of my friends, and I'm clearly not speaking for all of Silver Lake because, you know, I know there's a lot of different opinions out there, but we were more excited about the prospect of a Whole Foods that's got a cheesemonger and a butcher and a fishmonger, and it's got the hot bar and, you know, all of those elements that come in a Whole Foods.
And by the way, Whole Foods isn't saying that there won't be the cheese bar and the wine bar. They're not exactly saying what's going to be taken away from the full Whole Foods. So it might be that we will still see some of those things. And by the way, in Silver Lake, there are plenty of other places to get fancy cheese and fancy wine.
But by the way, this really does sound like the definition of first world problems, to the point that Dawn White and her friends actually mounted a petition. How's the petition doing?
Not so well. she's hoping to get 10,000 signatures by September 30th. At least that's what it says on the petition. Last time I checked, it has about 170. So it still needs a few more to get there. And, you know, people can leave messages on the petition. And some of them are really supportive. You know, one person said, "We don't want your test tube baby store. We want the whole kit and caboodle. Don't shortchange Silver Lake with your knockoff brand store." Somebody else makes the point, you know, it's pointless to put another discount market in the neighborhood when there's a Trader Joe's a mile away. One person was really dismissive on the petition and said, "Sometimes you find a cause so socially important, like race, gender, and economic inequality, that you're compelled to organize support. This is such a cause, representing my desires to fight for six-figure families and their neighborhood concerns."
Okay, so this guy was not taking it seriously.
Yeah, and I mean, even Dawn White acknowledges, you know, this isn't the biggest issue in the world. By the way, on the internet, people can sort of say things that they don't necessarily mean. There are a lot of trolls that come out on these kind of things. So I wanted to go and ask real people in real life what they think. I went to the Starbucks that's right in that plaza where the Whole Foods is going to be, where Ralph's used to be. And I asked a few people what they think about it.
Some people don't want a Whole Foods in Silver Lake to begin with because they're very expensive. I think the person complaining about it obviously makes a lot of money that most people in this neighborhood might not make per year. So
people are kind of glad that we're getting the budget one because we're not necessarily a high-end neighborhood. There's a lot of kids that live in this neighborhood too, and young people, so I think it's good.
But if it's cheaper, cool. If it's more expensive, not cool. You know,
I wish it was just a Whole Foods. I mean, why change the name? Why make it any different? Just because we're Silver Lake, you know, closer to Echo Park, it shouldn't be any different. We should have the same Whole Foods.
So a variety of opinions. A lot of people saying, who cares? Or I'd rather save some money. But there are a few people who say, no, I want it all. I want the choice.
Well, Avishai, you yourself live in the neighborhood. Will you embrace this 365 version of Whole Foods? Or do you feel miffed that you're not getting the real thing?
No, that's right. I live about a mile away. I'm not a Whole Foods shopper just because I think they charge too much. But, you know, I will check it out when it opens and maybe I will buy my kale and quinoa and lentils and whatever else you buy
at
Whole
things,
Foods.
All things gluten-free.
My $6 asparagus water or whatever they sell.
Well, Avishai, what a great story. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Francis.
Take it to the cheese counter, Humboldt Farm. We just ran out, sir. Really, dog? Take it easy, man. I try to calm myself. I've been on edge ever since they took kombucha off the shelf.
I'm Frances Anderton, and you're listening to DNA. Finally, this September has been the unofficial Frank Gehry and Eli Broad month, with the glitzy openings of the Gehry retrospective at LACMA and the Broad Museum on Grand Avenue. The finale for it all comes this weekend with a dinner for Frank Gehry at the Getty, where he will receive a Lifetime Achievement Medal. And his life will be bared at a talk Sunday between the Getty's James Cugno and the architecture critic Paul Goldberger. Paul Goldberg has written a biography of the architect. It's called Building Art, The Life and Work of Frank Gehry. And Paul came to the station to talk about it. I want to start a bit with you, actually,
sure.
And how you, as an architecture critic, architecture critics don't typically write about, they don't go that deeply into the architects themselves. The architecture critics write about buildings.
Yes. Well, it was a very different thing for me. You're absolutely right. I've spent my life writing about people's work, and I've never written about someone's life before. But it seemed to me to be a wonderful chance to push myself in a different direction, to do a different kind of writing at this stage of my life while still making use of everything I've learned over the years and of my passion for architecture and my knowledge about it. So I was not interested in writing a biography of a sheep farmer in New Zealand. I wanted to write a biography of an architect.
And not just an architect, arguably the most famous architect in the world, which is quite a challenge, I would say. There's a lot of baggage that comes with that.
There's a lot of baggage, of course, that comes with any living subject. It's tough writing a biography of a living subject. And I felt it was essential that it be made clear at the very beginning that it was my book and not Frank's. So I did not sign a contract with the publisher, with Alfred Knopf, until Frank and I had an agreement that he would cooperate with me, open up his archives, be available as much as I wanted to talk, and so forth, and at the same time accept that he had no editorial control over the project.
And part of the agreement, he agrees that he's going to make himself available and his archives available. What about his family members, his friends? Who did you speak to as part of this process?
I spoke to everybody who would speak to me, and that was almost everyone. He was very, very generous in encouraging his friends to speak to me and telling them that it was okay from his standpoint that they do so. The only person who declined to speak to me, only two people actually, his first wife, who is still living in Los Angeles, in fact in the house in which they lived for many years when they were married a long time ago, and their daughter, who...
Because he had two daughters. Sadly passed.
That's exactly right. The elder of the two daughters died of cancer a few years ago. The younger is still alive and healthy. And she preferred not to. Her uncle, her mother's brother, has remained very close to Frank over the years and was very, very gracious and generous in helping me fill in the story of that family. And so I feel very confident that their story is told in a fair way, even though they preferred not to speak directly to me. But dozens and dozens of other people did, clients, friends.
Enemies?
Yes. And in fact, I did speak to several people who had worked with Frank and left, in some cases, under unhappy circumstances and others under happy circumstances. They were all quite candid with me. And I think that probably was another part of the book that Frank was not super comfortable with. It makes it clear that he is a wonderful mentor in many ways, but when people become rise to very senior positions in the office and might be possible successors someday, somehow things don't go quite as well at that point, and most of them at one time or another leave. And so there were several people, including two people who had an equity stake in his office, the only time he'd actually shared ownership with partners.
Edwin Chan
actually did not. It was Randy Jefferson and Jim Glimpf, who worked with him for many, many years and really helped build the office into a major enterprise that could do buildings like Bilbao and Walt Disney Concert Hall. And they both left somewhat unhappily. They both spoke with great candor to me about Frank, and I think in a very clear-headed and fair way. They, I think, understood some of their own issues and shortcomings, and they knew that every failed situation has two sides to it. And so I think that those stories also are told in a way that's fair to all parties. Edwin Chan is another story entirely, of course, too. He was still is a brilliant designer who had become very much Frank's alter ego for many, many years and played a critical role in a lot of the most important projects, even all the way up to the Fondation Louis Vuitton in Paris that opened last year. And then Edwin, too, left about 4 years ago. Again, a relationship that was very, very, very close that somehow seemed to fade at a certain point, and Frank became disenchanted with him and his role in the office. It was also a time and appropriate, I suppose, that Edwin go off on his own, which he did.
But what you've just hinted at is that the story of Frank's life, dating right back to the beginnings, because actually Frank doesn't talk too much about his personal life. He doesn't talk too much about his Judaism or his, let's say, his Jewishness.
Yes, yes.
Not his Judaism, the opposite. He's an atheist.
Right, but he has a great Jewish sort of cultural identification. He has an increasing sense of himself as Jewish, even though he's not practicing in an observant religious sense. In fact, more and more often, it seems, these days, you hear Frank say something like, oh, of course I worry all the time. I'm Jewish. I mean, those identifications with his psyche, he feels Jewish, even if he does not choose to observe as a religious person and go to synagogue and do that kind of thing.
Well, but you've brought me onto a different point, which is the reality of mortality or the reality of getting older and coming to terms with one's life. And what you have just talked about seems to be something that happens as one gets older. One starts to reflect, one starts to perhaps take ownership of aspects of oneself, one's younger self, that one had rejected in intervening years.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think certainly Frank has done that in terms of Jewish identity. I can't imagine that he would ever want to be an actively practicing, observant Jew because it's not in his nature. But he certainly very much seems to feel and identify more in a general way. And you're right. I think he's beginning to look at his life in a kind of wholeness, which was why it was a good moment to do this book. Biographies, of course, are most often written after a person's life, when the life is completely over. Frank is happily very, very active still. And toward the end of this project, as he began to take on more and more new work, some of which was going to be clearly too late to make it into this book, he began to joke with me that you should already start volume two, because you'll have to do a volume two. He said, I'm going to keep going, so you better be ready. You have to, when this is done, you better start on volume two.
Right. And it's true. At the moment in L.A., everywhere one looks, there's a Frank project. He's doing something on the Sunset Strip. He's doing a pro bono project in Watts. And,
yes,
of course, he's got involved with the L.A. River. Incredibly.
Those are three critical projects, both very high profile in L.A. in particular, and all projects that began after this book was done. That's right. I think one of the things that he's coming to terms with in an interesting way is his relationship to L.A., which has been intimate, emotionally very important, but also very tempestuous in certain ways. And, you know, when Disney Hall ran into difficulty and stopped construction in the 90s, as you know, he was so embittered about Los Angeles and felt so rejected by his hometown that he gave serious thought to moving his office elsewhere. And he spent an enormous amount of, although he never did that, of course, he spent an enormous amount of time in airplanes, traveling all over the place, seeking and often getting work around the world, and less time at home. But just in the last couple of years, I've sensed a renewed interest in Los Angeles. And I think he would like to imagine that his legacy in Los Angeles is not just going to be some great buildings, Walt Disney Concert Hall being, I think, the greatest of them, but others as well, but also affecting the city in some broader way. I think that's why the LA River is very important to him. It's not actually architecture. It's not even quite urban design. It's a challenge of how to rethink this enormous, enormous piece of infrastructure and turn it into an asset for the 15 different communities that it passes through during the course of its 51 miles. So he's really more and more interested, I sense. I don't know how conscious this is. Maybe it's an unconscious response to this moment in his life. Maybe it's a conscious intention. But there's more and more interest in his Los Angeles legacy and not just his world legacy.
Well, you've prompted a couple of thoughts, one of which, again, to go back to the sort of arc of his life. Another piece of the early life that I found so fascinating was his architectural education.
Sure.
And his architectural experiences working with Victor Gruen, and then sort of finding himself in this kind of not quite a good fit planning class at
yes.
planning department at Harvard.
Yes.
But also his left-leaning politics,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
his which is something that people don't necessarily take seriously about Frank or recognize is there, because they associate him so much with his showpiece buildings and swishing around at fabulous parties. But no, deep down, there's this very there's a man with a social conscience that he wants to acknowledge.
I think you're absolutely right. He's always had this side to him. I think he's in a way torn or pulled in two directions, and it's another of the paradoxes of Frank. I mean, he certainly loves glamour. He loves being known by and sought out by famous people. He loves being a celebrity. He likes to pretend he doesn't, but he truly does love that. But he doesn't love only that. You know, he does not have the shallowness of that. In a way, that side of him is a sort of shallow overlay on top of a much deeper person, a shallow surface on a deeper person, if that makes any sense. And he's always cared very much about social issues. In college, he belonged to a group that was pushing very much for public housing and much more civic responsibility from architects. He is now doing a project in Watts as a pro bono effort, a very important project. You mentioned it a moment ago, a children's mental health center. But he's, from time to time, he's done a number of very important pro bono things. He's also contributed a great deal to scientific research. He's passionate about that. And there's a research award, a grant, the fellowship, that's given to a scientist every year in the name of his daughter. He set that up as a memorial to her. So I think you're absolutely right that at this moment in his life, as he thinks about his legacy, he wants to make sure that he's not remembered only for flashy, high-profile buildings, important though they are, and much as he loves them and has no desire to disown that part of his legacy.
But is there also another piece mm-hmm. to this, which is Frank's embrace of power? Frank, mm-hmm. and again, dating right back, you tell a story of a boy that grows up in a house with some real struggles, financial
yes, yes,
struggles, a
yes.
father who's kind of a failure. And Frank has made sure his life has not gone that way. And Frank has this, everyone, you know, uses that term, this all shucks personality, but he's a remarkable, I don't want to say manipulator, but he's a remarkable operator.
Yes. Operator is a very good yeah. word, actually. Yes, yes. And in fact, the aw shucks personality is a very clever facade that masks a very determined, ambitious person behind it who absolutely knows how to play the levers of power, but does it in his own somewhat eccentric but very successful, very effective way.
So give us some examples.
Well, he's always, at one point in the book, actually, I refer to him as a cross between Frank Lloyd Wright and Woody Allen.
That's good.
There is this sort of side of him that is so self-effacing, but very much as Woody Allen, in fact, knows how to, within the entertainment industry, move the levers of power, but in his own way, in his own direction. When Walt Disney Concert Hall ran into difficulty, Frank played behind the scenes quite brilliantly, actually, and managed to help get the mayor, Mayor Reardon at that point, on board to restore the project, which had ground to a complete halt. He essentially made himself a person within the power structure of Los Angeles who was not going to be dismissed as just an arrogant artist. The attempt to do that, the attempt to portray him that way, is one of the things that brought the project to a halt the first time around. And his cleverness in building a coalition of people who were going to see it otherwise and yet allow him to really control the project. The other reason the project came to a halt early on, as the book explains, is that he was not allowed to do the working drawings. Another firm was hired as the actual real architect to do the construction work. He insisted that wouldn't work. He gave in and allowed it to happen because he's fairly pragmatic, but predicted failure on that. And indeed, it did fail. And that delayed the project by years.
So as you wrote this book, did you have learn any things that really surprised you about Frank?
I think what I learned most was that he really is this contradictory, complex set of things. I think my instinct about him going in was borne out, but I now just have,
lots of evidence.
500 pages of evidence of it, exactly. There is a side to him that is narcissistic. There's a side to him that is self-centered. There's a side to him that is determined and arrogant. But there's also a side to him that is gracious, loving, kind, modest, and frightfully insecure. One of the differences between Frank and many other people who are very, very successful is that he admits that he is insecure. He does not pretend otherwise. And he will, when you really begin to talk with him at length, all of that comes out, all of those anxieties. He has never been 100% sure that he is right. And what an amazing thing, actually, to have that degree of self-doubt and yet that degree of determination to push forward and make your creations happen at the same time. So that what I learned in a way was not so much about Frank as an individual as about how these two things can sometimes coexist, that one can be as determined an architect in some ways as Howard Roark in the
Fountainhead.
The Fountainhead, and yet also full of insecurities and internal doubts and anxieties. But it's those things that keep him creating all the time. It's those things that make him feel that no building is a complete and total answer, that every single thing he does, every building, every project, his life itself is a work in progress in a perfect way.
Hence a lot of therapy.
Yes, there has been a great deal of therapy, which he, again, to his credit, talks very candidly about. And while his therapist is no longer living, and I did not have a chance to interview him for this book.
Milton Wexler, very famous.
Famous figure in Los Angeles, exactly. And I did read the transcripts for the last interview Milton Wexler ever gave about Frank in the Sidney Pollack film some years ago about him. And there's no question that Milton Wexler was absolutely essential to helping Frank understand and care about other people and how they react to his work. I think he's often misunderstood as, you know, an arbitrary maker of crazy shapes who just throws them at people. You know, because you know his work so well, that that's, it could not be farther from the truth, that those seemingly crazy shapes are actually part of an extraordinary design vocabulary that he has invented, that he wants to make and normally succeeds in making as responsive to function and practicality as any other work can be.
I don't think this is the purview of your book, but what you've just said does beg a question that I think about quite a lot, which is Frank's formal expressionism has been highly, highly influential.
Yes.
And I do wonder if a piece of his impact has been not entirely healthy, because it's given the impression to a younger generation that form is it, whereas what Frank is so good at and mm-hmm. that he's so underappreciated for is his planning, I think, his internal planning, his arrangement of the internal experience, the light, the spatial experience. And I wonder if that's something that's actually been lost from architecture education.
I don't know if it's been lost from architectural education, but it's an you're absolutely right that that's a huge miscomprehension about Frank. He is, in fact, enormously responsive to programs, to the program of a building. He also is very, very comfortable changing a building over and over again in response to what a client says to him. I think he doesn't like clients who don't get him at all. Those clients normally, however, self-select out of and don't hire him in the first place. Once he feels in sync with a client and feels that a client believes in him and his work, he is more willing to make changes than almost any architect I've ever seen. The problem that you raise about so much architecture being kind of Gehry-esque, I think to some extent that's inevitable when you have any great form maker. I mean, if we think of the greatest form makers of the 20th century, Frank Lloyd Wright, Le Corbusier, and Mies van der Rohe, all of them gave the impression that they were creating a language that others could easily do things in. It almost never really worked very well. Most of the great Miesian architecture is by Mies van der Rohe. Very few people did Wrightian architecture of much merit other than Frank Lloyd Wright, and so forth and so on. And in fact, I don't know that others really do Gehry terribly well. I think he would like, and I certainly would share this feeling, that his influence be felt in a less literal way. Because one thing he's never, ever believed in is mimicking. You know, he likes to respond to the context of a building not by imitating what's around it, but by acknowledging it with his own forms. But similarly, I think he really does not want to see his own work mimicked either.
There's another piece of Frank that I think certainly all young architects should be aware of, which is Frank is also an extraordinary businessman.
Yes.
Frank has had this other piece to his life, which is essentially a developer. He's always mm-hmm. made sure there's money in the bank through developing property. Is that something that you get into?
Yes. He develops or simply owns for investment purposes an awful lot of rather ordinary buildings, actually, buildings that generally he has not had anything to do with as an architect. He has a business partner, Larry Field, who's a Los Angeles real estate investor. Wonderful man. They're very, very different, he and Frank, but they get along wonderfully and they like each other and trust each other. And they have gradually assembled a very large portfolio of things. And in fact, Frank's financial security comes more from that than actually from his architecture. Well, he's a very, very, very successful architect. As we all know, even the most successful architects don't earn money the way, you know, hedge fund people earn money or investment bankers or what have you.
Which is another marvelous paradox about him, because, of course, the
Frank as artist persona has been so well molded and mythologized. But let's just, you know, cycle right back to the beginning of your book. Presumably that impulse comes from this childhood that turns out to have been really quite precarious.
Yes, yes. He grew up in a very poor family in originally in Toronto. They moved to Los Angeles when he was 18. And there was, for many years in Los Angeles as well as in Toronto, there was no money. And he drove a truck when he first came here and started out college at Los Angeles Community College taking night courses, and only later transferred to USC. And then his interest gradually moved toward architecture. But this was not a kid who was dreaming of being an architect when he was six. He learned about architecture in his late teen years and when he was already in school part-time, and gradually moved toward full-time and from ceramics, which he actually started in.
But he's born son of Irving Goldberg and his wife Thelma. Thelma's the one who becomes the great sort of cultural influence on him. But his father, he's constantly changing jobs, losing jobs, trying business efforts that don't work, but selling slot machines in the middle of nowhere.
That's
and
right.
It's this constant, I guess, modeling of a life that would make a child feel very unstable.
Yes, yes, that's exactly right. There was never a sense that there was a certainty of money. There was also not a great sense of a certainty of love from his father, who was, I think, a very troubled man, a man who often took out some of his own insecurities and despair over his professional failings on his son. At one point, when Frank was 17, they got into a physical fight. And it was a very painful relationship. Frank, for years, you know, tried to make it work better. And he knew his father deep down loved him. His father was a sad man who never quite made it. One of the things that is saddest of all to Frank is that his father never saw his own success, because he feels his father accused him of being a dreamer and not being practical enough. That was surely his father projecting his own sense of himself on Frank. And I think much of, as you suggest, in fact, much of the side of Frank that has built a financially secure portfolio of investment buildings separate entirely from his architecture is a response to his father, really, showing that, in fact, he is very practical, that he is not just a dreamer, but he also is a dreamer who has achieved his dreams in that sphere too, in that realm. So I think, will never fully recover from the sadness of the pain of not being able to share his success with his father.
So the last point you made suggests this man that is sort of constantly driven, and some of the forces that drive him are sadness and dark forces in a way. But part of that force is that, you know, Frank is the sort of energizer bunny. He just doesn't stop.
Right,
and
right.
One of the ways that manifests is this is a guy who's been physically very competitive over the years as well. I know you touch on that in the book.
Sure, sure. I mean, he was a hockey player all the way into his 70s. He is still a sailor and, in fact, just designed a new sailboat and continues to sail and has always been physically active. I think, you know, he's slowing down now, of course, as is inevitable, but that is absolutely part of the drive. His obsession with hockey led to there was an office team for many years called the Fog, his initials FOG. He designed a hockey rink for the Anaheim Ducks, the Disney-owned team in Anaheim. And his office, in fact, has all kinds of hockey jerseys from famous hockey players plastered on the wall.
He's a man with many sides, let's say. We should tell the story of his name change, because
sure.
That is something that he didn't talk about very much. In fact, I think for many years, people didn't even realize his name had changed.
Right. People for a long time did not realize that his name was originally Goldberg.
A little like your name, actually.
Well, one of the funniest moments in our many encounters over the years to research this book was early on, he said to me, "I've come up with the perfect title for your book. You should call it Goldberger on Goldberg."
Which would have been a good title, actually.
It would have been. I'm not sure it would have sold so well. Right, exactly. But he was Frank Goldberg. His first wife was uncomfortable with such a Jewish-sounding name. She was also Jewish, but her family...
Her family
was named Snyder. They may have changed their name themselves earlier on. I don't know. But in any event, it was a sort of neutral-sounding name. And she thought that she would be more comfortable with that. And when she was pregnant with their first daughter, she became more insistent about it, wanting the daughter to be born with a different name. And Frank reluctantly agreed. But when she argued that there was a fair amount of anti-Semitism in Los Angeles in the early 50s, which is when this was, 1954, and that he stood a better chance of getting jobs as an architect if he did not have an overtly Jewish name, he conceded that she was probably right. So he reluctantly agreed to the name change. He set one condition. He said he did not want to change his initials, so it had to be a G. So she said, fine. Let's find a sort of nice-sounding name that is with a G. They came up with the idea of Geary, G-E-A-R-Y, as in Geary Street in San Francisco. And he looked at that for a while, thought about it. Yes, it was neutral. It was a G. That was okay. But he looked at Goldberg and looked at Geary, and this is the wonderful part of it because he thought so much like a graphic designer or an architect would. He looked at the profile of Goldberg, and it starts with a G and goes down for the O and then up for the L and DB in the middle and then down again at the end. So he said, well, with Geary, we could do that if we get rid of the A in the middle and put it in an H. So it starts up, goes down, up. And so it's a skyline, exactly, and then ends with a letter going down like the G at the end of Goldberg. So it was an invented name to create the profile that resembled Goldberg if you just looked at the letters as a skyline, so to speak.
It's a terribly funny story. But if I understood correctly, then the rest of the family changed the name too.
They all changed their name. His father resented it and resisted it, but they felt in the end they should all have the same name. They were a family. They did, for all the stresses and tensions, love each other very, very much. And they all became Geary. That's right.
We've stayed a lot with his first marriage because it all coincides with his early life, which is so incredibly interesting because one does hear less about that. And we haven't even had a chance to get to his great love, Berta, who becomes the mainstay of much of his life.
Berta is an extraordinary and remarkable person who is been his mainstay, as you say. She is fiercely loyal, fiercely loving, has one of the great bullshit detectors I've ever seen, and I think has helped him understand all of his complex other sides, has supported him while quietly, reminding him what matters, what doesn't. She is so firmly grounded. She's one of the most grounded, centered people I've ever known, yet is also lively, vivacious, and charming. So she has all of those surface qualities, but a really strong key. If she were a sailboat, she would have a very deep keel. She stays on center all the time. And also works with Frank in the office as the chief financial officer of the firm. So she's very engaged in that way. And I don't think Frank could have accomplished what he has and could have remained as active as long as he has without Berta and without that very happy sanctuary of that marriage. But
and two sons.
And two wonderful sons.
He's very committed to his family.
Yes. Alejandro the first, who was an artist, and Sam the second, who is became an architect and, in fact, now works in the office, which is a source of enormous pride to Frank, that he has a child that has followed him in his career and is working with him. So it's a very, very happy, conventional family, actually, oddly enough, although they live in that extraordinary and unconventional house in Santa Monica, where the kids grew up there. They're now grown and elsewhere. Sam and his wife had their first child recently, so Frank is now a grandfather for the first time, which is also a sort of lovely, conventional experience that he's having for the first time through this second family. So there's no question Berta has been an amazing and extraordinary force behind the scenes. And she and Frank have a wonderful understanding of each other and respect for each other's differences, too. The book actually refers to a pair of parties that happened not that far apart, Frank's 80th and Berta's 70th birthday parties. Frank's 80th was this enormous event at the Temporary Contemporary in downtown Los Angeles with something like 500 people and all kinds of celebrities. And there's a lot about it in the book. And Brad Pitt was there. And
yeah,
all these
I
other
was
people.
There.
You were there, too. Of course.
Ariana everybody. Huffington
exactly.
And Bill Maher.
Exactly. You've got it. That was it. And Berta planned every detail of that because that was what she knew Frank would like. Frank, in turn, planned a 70th birthday party for Berta that was a surprise party. It was in a restaurant in Santa Monica. It was much smaller. It had family, including some of her family who'd come from Panama, some of Frank's and hers oldest friends. But, you know, there were no celebrities there. There were no bold-faced names. It was not a party that made the gossip columns. And Frank planned every detail of that himself. So, you know, they really do take care of each other in a wonderful way and respect each other's differences. They actually are a couple whose only pleasure, it seems to me, whose greatest pleasure, I should say, is in making each other happy. And I see those parties as each of them giving the other what they wanted.
That's a great duality. It's a great story. Well, finally, Paul, just to bring you back to your role as architecture critic, at the end of the day, where do you think he stands in architectural history?
Well, only history can truly determine where someone stands in history, but I think he's certainly the most important American architect living today, the greatest American architect since Louis Kahn, who in turn was the greatest American architect since Frank Lloyd Wright. And I think there's no question Frank Gehry will be remembered in the pantheon of great figures. Where he is in that pantheon, or whether it even matters once you're in that pantheon. You know, I mean, nothing is a more foolish waste of time than trying to rank Frank Lloyd Wright, Mies van der Rohe, and Le Corbusier, for example. So I think Frank Gehry will be remembered as in that category. But we shall see, you know.
And one of his most profound influences will have been in the technology, because really where he zoomed off was when he brought in Catia and he found a
that's
way
a
to...
subject we haven't even
we haven't
really
even touched on. Oh, my gosh.
And it's a huge subject because without digital technology, Bilbao could never have happened. Walt Disney Concert Hall could not have happened. So many buildings could not have happened. And he has been a leader in that. Has influenced the entire profession that way. And that's very important to him, actually. He has felt that one of the things that technology, which his firm has helped develop, can do is put more control of the overall building process into the hands of the architect. And the architect has been robbed of some of his or her original power as master builder by the complexities of construction today. But the computer is a way of restoring that to the architect's control. And he's very proud of the fact that several of his most large and complex buildings, thanks to this digital technology, have had no change orders, no no complicated things that have had to get refigured on the job, thus vastly increasing costs, but could be done entirely in advance, accurately by the computer.
Well, Paul Goldberger, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Francis.
Paul Goldberger's book is Building Art, The Life and Work of Frank Gehry. That's it for today's DNA. The show was mixed by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Find more DNA on our blog at kcrw.com/DNA and follow us on our Facebook page at KCRW's Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening.